it is essential for us to be able to cry, to mourn. It's a slippery slope if we don't process the pain. If it consumes us constantly, then it can be a slippery slope to losing our practice or losing our footing, our stability in the goodness that also exists. Terror attacks are not just attacks on the actual people who are being murdered tortured, abused. They are attacks on all of us watching. They are attacks on our soul, on our heart as human beings. And I think it's definitely, we must fight to retain our faith in the universe, in ourselves, in the innate quality of peace and goodness, because terror is not the nature of humans. It is deeply unnatural. That's why it's so horrific.
And welcome to Curious Ones podcast by Andara. I'm Yael Ginsberg, the host of the podcast, a yoga and meditation teacher and philosophy lover. Each week you will hear eye-opening interviews with the different teachers of the Andara Yoga Institute, located in beautiful Baja, Mexico, along with other teachers that pass through here. This life-changing knowledge shared through authentic, heartfelt communication will help you live a happier, more fulfilled, and connected life. Let's dive in. Hello, and welcome back to Curious Ones podcast by Andara. I'm Yael Ginsberg, and today I have the amazing Talia Sutra back on the podcast. Hello, Talia.
Thank you so much, Yael, for having me.
Of course. So just a little introduction. Other than being one of the most inspiring teachers, yoga teachers in the world today, Talia is also a fellow Israeli. And because of the crazy situation happening right now, I thought it's not right to speak about anything else. And I thought the most insightful and the most helpful thing would be to speak with someone like Talia, who can help us look at the situation from maybe a different, maybe higher perspective. So, Talia, I would love to start with just hearing a little bit of your thoughts about what's going on lately.
I mean, just as a disclaimer, I hope that no one has too high hopes or expectations of me. Like everyone else, I'm feeling absolutely heartbroken and overwhelmed with everything that's been going on since October 7th. My thoughts, I don't really have a lot of thoughts currently. I have a feeling, like feelings of distress and pain and overall not a good feeling like everyone else. So it comes and goes in waves. Obviously it was way more difficult in the first week, the first few days. I actually had to teach a training starting October 10th. And it was extremely challenging, but at the same time, really came as a saving grace, because I had these 3 hours a day when I was teaching where my mind was free from that pain and tension. And I was able to focus completely on the topic and on the students, which was a real blessing. But yeah, it's been extremely difficult. Yeah, like I'm sure for you and for anyone else who is, you know, feeling and whether they are personally impacted or not, just taking in that level of human pain and suffering is extremely difficult. So I have been going through that as well, and obviously doing the best that I can using the tools that I have and the practices to help at least to manage the pain that I'm feeling.
Yeah, it seems that the whole world is affected by what is happening, whether it's looking at and seeing the extreme pain and suffering through the videos and everything that's happening in social media, whether you are living here in the area, the big meaning of the larger area, and being affected by the leadership and what's happening and the rockets and the real threat, or also the extreme division that's going on in the world right now. I feel like everybody is affected in one way or another. You spoke a little bit about using your practices to manage the trauma and the pain. Could you maybe speak about that a little bit?
Well, I think because of my training in yogic practices, I am able to hold space and process difficult feelings. And I know that my body also needs to be involved in the release of trauma. So that has been extremely helpful. I would say that it is essential for us to be able to cry, to mourn. And that's what I spent, I think, a few days doing, is just allowing myself to mourn whenever I could. It's not easy when, you know, as a parent, when we have young children around, we need to hold space for them. But to have some space and some time to just cry, to just feel the pain and mourn. And I think that is something that every person who is grieving needs and deserves. So I hope that if you have been personally affected by this, if you are in Israel, in Palestine, and you are grieving huge amounts of pain and suffering, then we really need to have the time to grieve and to feel the pain that we're holding. There was definitely an attempt to understand why this would be, and I think that's natural. Maybe other people can relate to asking why, like, why is this happening? Why are, I'm not going to go into the graphic details and the words here, but why is this, why are these unbelievably cruel events taking place to the most innocent of people? Why is this happening? And receiving obviously no answer. There's never a logical or rational explanation. There's no explanation. And that can be also extremely challenging, because at least for me, I think my nature is to try and find order, or like find sense. Like that's how I'm built. So like I always try and find sense in something, or like how can this be? And it's beyond sense, and it's beyond any kind of logic. So that's very hard. It's very hard for human beings, or at least for me, to allow for that. So there was for me, I understood that I needed to, before any attempt to move on a little bit, not move on meaning forget about it, but move on meaning I'm able to also function in daily life. I needed to grieve. I needed to cry. I needed to struggle with God and ask all these questions. And once that was done, then I was also able to use tools like chanting, mantra, asana, pranayama, all the tools that, you know, many of you listening might be familiar with, singing, bhakti practices, prayer, all of those practices, to help me also feel that I'm beginning to convert some of the pain into prayer, into loving energy towards people, towards myself, to continue to essentially have faith and belief in humanity, you know? So like, I feel like that's the second step, you could say, because it's a slippery slope. If we don't process the pain, if it consumes us constantly, then it can be a slippery slope to losing our practice or losing our footing, our stability in the goodness that also exists in the world, in our faith in God or our faith in the universe, however, you know, individuals might relate to it, but a power of good. And that's what I was also protecting for myself, is this ability to stay focused despite the unbelievable pain, to stay connected to a sense of love, a universal love, a universal sense of peace and truth, and not let it get lost, to continue to fight for it. Because I think also these terror tactics and terror attacks are not just attacks on the actual people who are being murdered or tortured, abused. They are attacks on all of us watching. They are attacks on our soul, on our heart as human beings. And I think it's definitely, we must fight to retain our faith in the universe, in ourselves, in the innate quality of peace and goodness, because terror is not the nature of humans. It is deeply unnatural. That's why it's so horrific. And that's what we have to remember, is that these acts are horrific acts, and they should not be equated with our human nature. I think human nature, our true nature, is benevolent. It is good. It is loving, compassionate, forgiving. So it's a huge manipulation. Something really toxic has to be implanted in the human mind to be able to carry out acts like this. It is unnatural. And that's what I have to also, because again, I've been blessed and privileged to be able to study yoga most of my life. I know that the nature of all beings, not just humans, of all beings, the nature of all beings is unconditional love, is unconditional peace, unconditional joy. And I know that might be really hard to hear, especially if you're in pain and you probably think that's not true. It can't be true because of what I've witnessed. But I know that it is, and I also will never give that up. So I know that if you're really, really struggling right now, you might think, you're very naive to think this, and it's definitely not true. But it's not even a belief, it's a knowing. I know that that's the truth. I know that that's the truth of all beings, no matter how cruel the human mind can be manipulated and twisted to really unrecognizable dimensions. But even if it takes lifetimes, billions of lifetimes, eventually we are all returned. We are all dissolved back into the reality, the ultimate reality of unconditional love, unconditional compassion, unconditional peace, which is truth. And the rest of it, it comes and goes. And that is what I have been returning to in my practices, and that's what I've been fighting for internally for myself. And what I would encourage any yogis listening to continue to insist on for themselves.
Helya, that's really touched my heart in such a deep way, because that is so true. It's not just an attack on the people who are being attacked. It's an attack on all of our humanity and the way that we view the world and interact with the world. I don't remember exactly how you said it, but I felt it really strongly. And that is kind of what I meant when I was hoping to speak in a higher perspective, because I think that right now I hear this also with the people around me and just the rhetoric in the country. Of course, many people want to have peace and they strive for peace. And yet after witnessing such horrible things throughout all these 2 weeks, many, many people are kind of regressing into the survival aspect of, now I need to go down to this level in order to protect myself and my family. And I know, as you say, I know in my heart that returning darkness to darkness is not what's going to move us forward. And I would love to hear from you a little bit about, what would you say to somebody who is now, somebody who considers themselves a peaceful person, a person who wants to love and live in peace with their neighbors, but at this moment all they could see is the animalistic acts that were carried out, and maybe even pulled towards wanting to take revenge or, you know, hurt other people?
Yeah. Firstly, that is the goal of terrorism. Like I said, the goal of terrorism is not just to hurt and murder, usually innocent civilians, but it is beyond that, is to instill fear in the hearts of millions, maybe billions of people, and to degrade them spiritually. To degrade them into, like you said, force them into survival consciousness. To force them into survival consciousness so that we're constantly in fight or flight mode, or constantly watching out for an enemy. And when we're forced to live life like this, we cannot develop ourselves as individuals spiritually, which we know is really what all of us are here for and what we all seek. We seek safety, of course. We seek safety of ourselves and of our families, and we should all have that all over the world, all beings. I'm not sure if these headphones are working, but all beings deserve to be safe and free, and to not be treated with cruelty, and to not be murdered or abused in any way. Obviously, we all know this. This is like basic morality, basic ethics, but terrorism tears that down and justifies the killing of innocents, the abuse of innocents. And then it also instills fear, confusion. And that's what we're seeing in the world, is we're seeing that people are in a state of fear. People are in survival consciousness. And then outsiders who are just watching essentially may not have any ties to the conflict itself, are voicing also extremely dangerous statements, oversimplifying the situation and taking sides, so to speak. I think this is what the terrorism wants, is to separate people, to separate, to create fear in individuals, to also create separation amongst people. As we're seeing in all over the United States, we're seeing in the UK, in Europe, we're seeing separation that is being sown. This is what they're looking for, exactly. This is how they begin to instill what it is that they want to instill. Essentially, the opposite of peace and love and understanding and compassion. So like I said, it's like those things that are most unnatural to humans that make us inflamed. You can see the inflammation in people. They're screaming at each other. They are fighting with each other, whether it's on social media or on the streets or in Israel, in where it's all taking place. So we can see that their goal is to create fear, to threaten lives, to sow division, to sow confusion and doubt. All of this is what's taking place right now, and I think that is not accidental. It's because it's planned. This is very much a planned tactic to begin to shake up the world, or shake up the order, or at least the relative peace that we've had globally. Relative, right? Obviously, we have horrible tragedies happening all the time. So I say relative peace. Since the end of World War II, we've seen a relative peace. There's obviously conflicts and horrific events that are taking place globally, not just in Israel and Palestine, as sometimes the media portrays it to be. There's actually horrific things happening all over the world. But specifically with what's happening in Israel and Palestine, I would say that the terrorism is not necessarily just random. I think it is really tactful, and I think that they know that they want the division that we're currently seeing in the world. The brother turning against brother, sister against sister, inability to connect, feeling that one person's pain needs to justify another person's pain. That kind of mentality is something that I think is very much what they want to do. So again, the terror is not just on the field of war. It's in the field of our mind. And that's what really, when I say keep to your practice and keep practicing, don't let it consume your soul. Don't let it consume your mind, is because that is definitely a part of the tactic, is to attack your own mind, to attack your own body. And we cannot, that is in our, at least is in our hands. Unfortunately, almost nothing is in our hands. We can't control. There's very little we can't control. We in some countries, we're lucky enough to be able to vote for our leaders and so on and so forth. But even then, is it really in our hands what they choose to do, what policies they allow, what they don't? And there's very little that's in our hands. We can demonstrate, we can protest, we can show our voices, even in a democracy. And that's great that we're able to do that. But at the end of the day, the only thing we really have a vote on is how we choose to keep ourselves, how we choose to keep our mind and our heart, and how we choose to respond to life as it shows up. And it shows up moment by moment. So it's never just a one-time choice. It's a choice moment by moment of how we're going to show up and who we're going to be.
100%. Hey, I'm quickly interrupting the episode to extend an invitation. If you are interested in deepening into any of the subjects we talk about on the podcast, we offer many different experiences on our beautiful grounds here in Baja, Mexico. From 9-day modules such as sound healing and yoga nidra, to breath and meditation, as well as 200 or 300-hour yoga teacher trainings, and many different shorter retreats. Check out our website, yandara.com, to see all the information about the different experiences. Let's get back to the episode. I made a video recently about victim mentality and how it's a choice. And one girl that I know was really kind of pushing back on it, on how it's not really our choice to be a victim, and how we... how hard it is to rise up above the situation. What are some of the tools that you use in order to protect yourself and really choose internally how you react? Because I think becoming a victim of the situation or reacting in kind of a survival way is very tempting. It even can feel good in a way. And it takes a lot of effort to rise up and consciously choose how we want to react internally. How do you approach that?
I mean, firstly, I think I just have to say that, like, there's a process to all of this. So like I said, I think in the beginning, we mentioned we need the time to grieve. We need the time to fully process our pain, and that can take, longer in some than others. It's not like there's a measurable amount of time in which grief is processed. So for everyone, this takes place differently, and there's no right or wrong way to do it. But really, we should make an effort to process the grief, because otherwise what happens is it turns into hostility. When it's unprocessed, the grief, the pain, it turns into hostility. Essentially, it's survival mode again, the survival consciousness, fight or flight. And we're just going to fight whoever is next to us. So it could be like our partner, our friend, our husband. And again, it goes back to that terror being implanted in us and dividing us from people. So it goes back to that. So firstly, make sure that you're processing your pain and that you understand the difference between grief and sorrow and sadness and anger. Know the difference between the two, because we also have to understand that those emotions are different. And what sometimes shows up is anger, underneath it, there is sorrow that needs to be felt. And sometimes people are disconnected from the ability to feel sorrow. So there's anger, and all that comes out is anger, but that's never going to be cleansing. We need anger, it gives us a sense of energy or a sense of movement, but it doesn't allow us to really get to the core of what it is that we need to feel and process. So the firstly, I would say you need to feel your pain. You need to cry. You need to feel your pain and hold it, really hold it. I like the tool of Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Zen monk, and he would say, hold your anger like a crying baby. So usually when we have anger, we want to kind of throw it at the next possible passerby, whoever kind of slightly aggravates us. But anger shouldn't be passed around. It should be held like a baby, meaning the same as if you saw a crying baby, you'd know what to do. You just pick it up and hold it close to you and kind of say, it's okay, it's okay. It's the same thing when you feel that there's anger inside of you. You need to sit with it and really tell yourself internally, right, like you would to a baby, it's okay, until it softens. It softens into the sorrow that it really is, into the grief. So firstly, you need to grieve. Now, the people are victims. There are people who are victims. And that's what we also need to differentiate, because these spiritual teachings are extremely important. But again, people who are in actual survival situations, like life or death situations, for most of them, they're not going to be sitting and meditating on the absolute, right? They're not going to be thinking about how I can shift my consciousness. They're just trying to survive. Some people are actual victims. And in that case, when we are in survival mode for real, like we are in a war zone, or we are, God forbid, in a situation where we need to defend ourselves, we have to defend ourselves. So just to be clear, in terms of yogic yoga philosophy is very vast, but in terms of the philosophy that I study and how I understand it, it is our ahimsa, nonviolence, doesn't mean doing nothing when someone is attacking you, whether that attack is physical, God forbid, physical, emotional, mental, verbal, whoever is attacking you. And it doesn't have to be, you know, just in a war zone. That goes to anyone. That goes to anyone. If someone is attacking you, if someone is abusing you, ahimsa, the yogic virtue of ahimsa, nonviolence, does not mean you let this happen. Just to be very clear, ahimsa means causing no harm to others. Causing no harm to others. It does not mean allowing harm onto the self. God forbid that you misunderstand this. So if something is happening that you are being attacked, whether emotionally, physically, spiritually, you have a right and a duty to defend yourself and to defend your body, to defend your mind, to defend your dignity. All of that needs to be defended. So this we learn in all Indic philosophy, but especially if you're familiar with Bhagavad Gita, the famous epic from India. The Bhagavad Gita is a Lord's song. It really takes place on a battlefield. It takes place on a battlefield. And the main character, Arjuna, he does not want to fight because he's fighting his family, actually. He doesn't want to fight his family. And Krishna is the charioteer, but of course he's also the formless divine. He is the divine personified in that moment as a person, as a being that you can see and touch and hear. And he essentially guides Arjuna to understand what his dharma, what his personal duty is, what he must do, and why he actually must defend his family and his people and his dignity and dharma itself, righteousness itself. He must defend it. So when we are an actual victim of abuse, because that does happen, sometimes we are, it's not just victim mentality, but an actual victim reality where we are being abused. If we are being harmed or abused, it is our duty to defend ourselves. And that goes the same in terms of when we look at countries. When a country is being attacked, it has a duty to its citizens to defend those citizens. And that goes to every country in the world. If a country is attacked, if civilians are attacked, that country must protect their people. It's that is in terms of the dharmic point of view. What do we do philosophically in terms of dharma? It would be adharmic, not unrighteous. It would be unrighteous, of course, not to defend your people from attacks. So all of this to answer back to the victim question. Some people are victims, and so they need to be defended, which is what we're seeing right now, why this war began. Because, of course, innocent people, so many innocent people, 1,400 people were murdered, people at a dance party, people at a music festival, people just sleeping in their homes. The 1,400 people were brutally attacked and murdered. The response of their country, in this case Israel, is to go and root out or defend the country, root out the evil that did this, and also make sure that it doesn't return. It's not a recurrent threat. So in terms of the response, I think when we have a victim of something, whether we are a country or we are a person, we have a responsibility to defend the victims. We have a dharmic or a moral obligation, an ethical obligation to defend the victims. That's one. So there are cases where we are victims. And if that's the case, we need to seek help. If we are a victim of abuse, any kind of abuse, we must seek the help of someone who can help us, help defend our dignity and our rights, and hopefully distance ourselves completely from the abuser. So again, this is not just in the case of war. It could be in any situation. Now, if we have something else, which is, I think, what you're referring to, victim mentality, where we are in a loop, an internal a kind of psychological loop of life is always happening to me. This is happening to me. I have no power. I have no strength. To me, this is a sign that we need to take personal responsibility for something. So that's something else. When we are in a loop of victim mentality, usually it means that I'm saying, I can't do anything. I have no power. This is always happening to me. I didn't do anything. I don't know why this is happening, and this keeps happening to me. So we can see that on an everyday kind of situation, you might want to see if this is something that you're a narrative that's happening in our mind, right? In our relationships, our relationship with ourselves, our relationships with our colleagues, with friends, with partners, family, so on and so forth. Because if it's happening in one relationship, it's probably happening with all relationships, and it starts with us. So how to fix that would be to take personal responsibility. That means, oh, I see that so-and-so, this friend or this person I know, made me feel, whenever I'm with them, maybe I feel in some way diminished, or I don't feel heard, or whatever the situation is. So instead of continuing in the cycle of saying, well, I always feel this way, I never feel good, I never feel empowered, what we could do instead of, let's say, just complaining internally about this is I probably have a couple of choices. Choice one is to try and understand exactly how I feel and articulate to that person as clearly as possible how our relationship is causing me to feel so-and-so. And in that way, I'm taking responsibility, at least from my end, right? I can say I can't change that person, but at least if maybe our relationship is meaningful enough to them, they'd be willing to change maybe their language or their behavior to work with me. So I can say, listen, I feel that when I'm with you, you're not letting me. Firstly, you always interrupt when I'm trying to say something to you, always interrupt me, never let me share about how I'm feeling or what I want to tell you. And this makes me feel, you know, diminished or not equal in the relationship. And that person may say, oh my God, I didn't know. I didn't know that I was doing that. Thank you so much for telling me. And then that could be a great healing point for the relationship, because I took responsibility for how I felt and I decided to share it with the person. And that person was open to, because it wasn't a judgment, it was just a genuine share of like, I don't feel right, let's work on this together. And maybe I could even say, let me know what I'm doing, what I could do to improve as well. That's another layer of taking responsibility. What can I do to approach you better, to understand you better, to speak to you better? What can I do? Let me know. Or if I'm doing something that is unconscious in some way, please let me know and I can work on it. That would be an example of a healthy problem solving within a relationship. Obviously simplified, but something like that. But if the person says, what are you talking about? I never do that, right? They're immediately defensive. They say, it's all in your head, right? So it's kind of like gaslighting. It's saying, I don't know what you're talking about. It's all you. I didn't do anything. I never do that. It's you. You're the problem. You know, and so we have like this complete denial of what's happening. And that could be, maybe if you're listening, you've had this experience with a partner, with a sibling, or with a colleague, or whatever. This is very common in relationships. And sometimes we can move through it. But in terms of victims, again, some victims are real victims. They're victims of violence or abuse, and we need to defend them as much as possible. And other times, we have a victim mindset, which again means, just to summarize, that we are stuck in a narrative, and we're doing nothing to change that narrative. We're stuck in a certain mental narrative, but we're not taking any effort or step to change it. So we're taking no personal responsibility. Personal responsibility shows up like holding space for myself, my feelings, journaling my feelings. That's taking responsibility. Talking to someone if I need to talk, like not talking to my neighbor, not talking to my mom on the phone about someone and what they did and how could they do that. Instead of doing all of that, it's talking directly to the person. That's taking responsibility. Like, I didn't feel comfortable with what happened. You mind speaking about it? So that can be another really mature way to speak to people. Even when we have uncomfortable things going on, we can still speak to each other and grow. And obviously it's trial and error. I think when I'm now saying this, I remember so many times just over the years, maybe not doing this skillfully. So it's definitely something that requires effort. In the beginning, it's a little messy, you know, confronting someone that we know about how maybe we can improve our relationship or something that bothers us. And at first it can be a little messy, but you can't get really good at something without starting, and starting out is always messy. So those are my thoughts on the victim mentality. And I also think, you know, it's very normal when we are in such a difficult time like we are today that we hear different narratives. We are in this war, and it's not just a war that started October 7th. Obviously, it's been going on for almost 100 years. There are two sets of narratives, and within those sets of narratives are victim narratives, but also very real victims on both sides. And that's what I think makes this so difficult. And the dialogue, right? It's hard enough between two people, right? Conflicts. If you have a conflict with one person, not even a whole nation, but if you have a conflict, think about it, with just one person. If you're listening to this right now, I'd really like you to ask yourself, honestly, was I able in my life to successfully resolve a relationship conflict? And if that's true, and you really resolved a conflict with someone successfully, and you've grown together out of it, then that's rare, and that's amazing. And you should be so proud that you're able to do that, because for most people, I'm guessing the answer would be no. We have conflicts with people, and we kind of like go off in opposite directions, and we probably harbor feelings of rage and anger, maybe even hatred inside. And that's, again, it's unfortunate, but it's something that is going to be more common than real, holistic, wholesome conflict resolution, even with two people, just two people. So 100%. Just to understand how difficult it is to approach even a dialogue between two nations that both have histories, attachments, passion, you know, and real pain attached to those histories and those narratives. So it's extremely difficult, extremely difficult. And of course, there are real victims on both sides. And the important thing is that, again, personally, I do what I can to take responsibility for myself. I can't take responsibility for a whole nation. I can't even take responsibility for the next person next to me. I can only take responsibility for myself. So at a certain point, we also have to be mature enough to say, I have to take responsibility for my feelings, for my pain, for my bias, for my misplaced passions, right? So how can I realign myself or come to a place of as close to equanimity within myself as possible? That's that's really ultimately the best that we can do, and hope that we can inspire equanimity, critical thinking, compassion in others as well.
It reminds me of the saying from Gandhi, be the change you want to be in the world. Because yeah, really it is only our own internal reaction and external reaction that we have ultimate control over in some way or another. And this is really why I wanted to talk with you today, because to argue about who's right, who's wrong, you know, who has more pain, who has more trauma, I don't think that's ever going to take us anywhere, because we both have pain, we both have trauma, and we both have the right to live a peaceful life, meaning the Israeli and the Palestinians, specifically talking about the conflict. And it is really an interesting point that you brought up, that even just in one conflict with one person, it is so difficult for us to really come and speak in such a open and truthful way. And now we are talking about two nations that honestly, sometimes I wish we could just, you know, part ways and just live our own lives and not bother each other. But that is not possible, because we're on the same land and we're in the same place and we live shoulder to shoulder with each other. And I also really appreciate that you spoke about being a victim and surviving harm on two different levels, because there is the level of real survival and real attack and needing to defend ourselves. And then there is the more everyday level of non-life-threatening conflict. And yet I also see the connection, because once we take away the threat and we defend ourselves, then we still have the responsibility, the personal responsibility of taking action and not letting that experience define who we are, and living it over and over in our minds and making that our whole identity, but rising up from the pain, from the hardship, and choosing consciously to not let that define our experience. I would love to speak with you. There's two things that I want to go into. Maybe I can like consult with you, because I don't want this to be like specific about who's right or who's wrong, but we're talking about kind of a narrative in the world right now about defending ourselves, Israel defending itself in a proportionate way. I don't know what that means, and I don't know how that can be really done today, especially when we're trying to defend ourselves in front of somebody who's hiding behind its own people. I would love to hear your views on this.
Well, again, I try and be as objective as possible, but as a disclaimer, obviously I am Jewish and I was born in Israel. I lived in Israel half my life and obviously have deep emotional and spiritual attachments to my Jewish identity and to Israel as I know it. So that's my disclaimer. I definitely feel a personal connection to the Jewish people and Jewish history. So that being said, I try and be, as like I said before, rational and look for clear understanding and facts. And I'm not, as a person, I can honestly say that I'm not like motivated by emotion alone. So I feel emotion, I process it, but I usually consult my intellect, my higher thinking faculties, and I always look also for as much as possible objectivity in any situation, right? So that being said, I have been seeing a lot in the media something about a proportional response and so on and so forth. The history of anti-Semitism is very long. If you go on, this is really something that you could do if you want to. You can Google or go on Wikipedia and just look the history of anti-Semitism. And it doesn't even fit on like one Wikipedia like page, because it starts on their page. I've been doing some research to try and, you know, like I said, like understand all of this. And it goes back to the Wikipedia page, I think like 700 BC or maybe even earlier. And it goes every 30 years. It lists a specific attack, burning people alive, mass murder of women and children. So it's really eye-opening to really look at this records of history. There's probably more that isn't recorded, but there is a lot that is recorded, and you can go and see since what they have recorded on Wikipedia, for example, which is a pretty simple list, but it is a list from around 700 BC all the way to today, and there's several pages because it couldn't fit it on one page. Every 30 years from 700 BC, there's an attack that happens on this specific group of people in the world, and specifically targeting like just people, just these Hebrew people or these Jewish people, whatever they're called throughout the ages, the same group of people, and they are continuously being attacked or driven from their home or attacked where it is that they're now forced to live, or they're being kicked out for not converting, or they're being killed for being blamed for some crazy problem in whatever is happening at that time in that region. It's always the scapegoat. So, I mean, the history of attacks on the Jewish people are ancient. The scope of the history of it, the suffering of the Jewish people, it's so ingrained. I mean, collectively, I think we all feel it. The Jewish people feel that collectively, but also it's not, you know, we often quote or refer to the horrors of the Holocaust and we say never again. And the Holocaust is the most recent event that took place that really shook us, and I hope the world, to the core of what should never happen again to any people. But the violence against Jewish people, whether again it's murder, displacement, capturing, murder, abuse, torture, burning people alive, all of that, it goes back literally thousands and thousands of years. So this event that took place this month, October 7th, horrific as it is, I think it's also good to know that it's not new in our history. It's not new in the history of, not to say that it hasn't happened to other humans. Other humans have suffered all over the world from people who have, I guess, not much of a regard for life and the value of life. But in terms of the Jewish people, what makes it interesting is that they are an ancient people, people from ancient times that are still around today, meaning speaking the same language, celebrating the same festivals, holding the same religious ideas, studying the same books, praying the same to the same, using the same prayers. All that is pretty remarkable. That is more than 3,000 years of history, and that history is rich with also beautiful, incredible contributions to society. But the pain and suffering and the persecution of the Jewish people is nothing new. It's not original. It's not new or original. It's been around for literally thousands of years. So it's not new. It's so horrific and sad that in 2023, we're seeing acts being done that, again, are so, I think, the opposite of human, of the idea of human nature and what we're really capable of, which is connection and compassion, God consciousness. It's not, it's the opposite of that. So it's really sad to see this, but also what gives me hope and strength is knowing that in the 3,000 years of these constant attacks, there are really very little breaks. If, again, go and look on this Wikipedia page on your own and see, or study this topic because it's, if it's interesting to you, but there's very little breaks. Still these ancient people, the Hebrews, the Israelites, the Jews, they're here. They're still here. And despite being quite a small nation, I think the constant attacks have actually made us quite strong as people, because if you think of anything that's constantly being attacked, like let's say an immune system even. When an immune system is being attacked but isn't being crushed, that immune system gets stronger. It is able to withstand more. So in general, I would say that Jewish people have a certain strength to them because they have withstood quite a lot. And so that is something that, again, I'm saying I'm a little biased to, because I feel connected to that collective Jewish identity and pain and also triumph. I feel connected to both. In terms of the proportional reaction, all of that, I think that to me is something that Israel is being specifically targeted with. And I think that this comes from unconscious, deep unconscious anti-Semitism in people, in the world which is observing, you know, like how deeply dehumanizing to have to prove to the world and to reporters that children were actually tortured and burned alive and murdered and beheaded. How incredibly sick to ask victims, actual victims, not to give them the time to mourn, not to give the Jewish nation internationally, not just Israel, but the Jewish nation internationally, not to be given the time to mourn, but to be on the defense immediately and to explain ourselves why we are actually responsible for these horrific attacks. So I think there is an unconscious anti-Semitism that's always been around, but it always changes its face. And I think right now, the face that it's showing is the face of the liberal media and the left, leftist spectrum of politics. And it can be a little bit surprising, I think, because we last saw it show itself through the right, extreme right and fascists and Nazis. And it's very different where we are now, where, you know, you have liberals, which usually align very much with Jewish ideals and Jewish sense of morality and ethics and rights for humans, human rights, which is something that Jewish thinkers have always promoted and stood behind. And we still do, of course. But at the same time, when it comes to Jewish people being able to defend themselves, or Jewish people being deserving of dignity or self-defense, you know, in their own country, those things are kind of thrown out the window a bit. Again, not always, but we see these trends happening in the liberal West, in universities, where it's become, you know, kind of expected that if you want to be a liberal, well, you also have to be extremely critical of anything Israel does. And essentially of the very right of Israel to exist. So I think that there is definitely a bit of a bias there. I don't know what a proportional response would be. I don't think that there's any Israeli soldier, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think I am, that would want to go and do those acts to anyone in Gaza. So that would not, definitely not, that option of proportionality is not available, because no one would do that. And also we would never, the Jewish people would never stand by that. The Israeli people would never stand by that. So
that wouldn't be
I don't know what a proportional response would be, but in terms of there are laws for war, right? There are laws for everything, and there are also laws for war and for what we can do and what we can't do, what a nation can do and what it can't do in a situation, in a war situation. I'm obviously not a lawyer, but I, as far as I understand in the research that I've done, there has been no law, no international law that has been broken in terms of Israel's response to the horrific attacks from the terror organization. So, I mean, again, we have to be able to communicate. So if you're listening to this and you immediately want to say you're wrong, and yes, but yes, civilians, 1,400 innocent civilians were killed, but, right, if that's the immediate reaction, then we need to step back. I think we need to step back and really take that in and understand the facts. Israel, also we have to understand that Israel is a country in the world. It has borders. It has certain borders, and it has civilians. It has also the right, the international right, to defend itself against terror attacks, just like France has the right to defend itself and its citizens, just like the USA or Mexico or anywhere else. All these countries have boundaries, have borders, and have armies to help defend themselves against any sort of attack. So Israel is the same way. If we have a fundamental problem with Israel existing, then that's something that we need to really get to the bottom of, right? If we have a problem with Israel as a state existing, then I think that's what a lot of us may need to do some work to understand, to go back and try and understand where it is that that problem is sourced from. Right. So, but in terms of international law, there isn't, there are no war crimes being committed by Israel, at least as far as I understand. And from the research that I have done, I listened to an incredible, lawyer, speak on the BBC on this topic. And she explains it very well. So that could be another thing to, Google, or maybe I'll send you the link to her speaking later so you can attach it, because she can speak about this much better than I can. But in terms of Israel's right to defend itself, there's no question there that not only is it allowed to, I mean, I can't believe I even have to say that, but it has to. It goes back to that idea of dharma. If someone is doing something that is so not right, it is not right, it is our duty not to allow that to happen when it's happening in our personal space. Like if someone is trying to cause harm or suffering to us, we have a duty to make sure that it doesn't happen to us. And it's the same thing for a country, whether that country is Germany or it's Israel or it's Colombia, it doesn't matter. If there is an external attack on civilians, on soldiers, on whoever, that country has a dharma, a right, a duty to protect its people. So that's where I stand with this. I don't really have a doubt there. Like I said, I definitely have a connection, an attachment in my heart to my Jewish roots and identity. But at the same time, even if I wasn't, logically speaking, a country and civilians are attacked, that country must do everything in its power to defeat the enemy, while at the same time practicing as much as possible ethical warfare. So we should make sure that civilians, that innocent people in Gaza are not being harmed. For that reason, I think they are being told to move out and move towards the south border. Obviously, this is not ideal, and wars are not ideal. Like, wars are not fun, and there are no real winners. Everyone loses because there's pain everywhere. There's suffering and destruction everywhere. But I think the, at least from my point of view, and I think from the point of view of most governments worldwide, whether it be the UK, the European Union, the USA, that enemy is Hamas, which is a terrorist organization, just like ISIS, and it must be defeated. We must hope that this enemy is defeated and that future generations of Palestinians are no longer ruled by a terrorist organization and taught from a young age to engage with life in such a way. So if we hope for peace, I think what we all need to recognize is that Israel has a right to exist and Palestinians have a right to exist, both, right? So Palestine should exist and Israel should exist, and we should have a conversation amongst ourselves. We should have a hope for a dialogue with leaders who are capable of doing that. But I think communication with terror, with a terror organization, is very difficult if your intention is peace. So
this terror organization, their only intention is murder and the complete annihilation of the Jewish people. And I think you're very right. I think the fundamental issue here is Israel basic right to exist, and also the Palestinians' basic right to exist. That's being kind of debated on the world stage and in the internal stage. And speaking from, again, I'm also Israeli and also unbiased or biased in this conversation because of my attachments and because of my personal safety at this moment, but also it has become clear from what has been happening in the last few weeks that the organization that is leading the Palestinian people will not stop until Israel is completely extinct. And there is no conversation when we acknowledge the right for both nations to exist. There is no conversation with a leadership that doesn't acknowledge that as a fundamental truth.
Right. Right. So that is the fundamental problem, because it would be like a, like, again, you have a relationship with someone in your life, that it could be like a neighbor, and maybe that neighbor, is making some noise. And so you go to the neighbor and say, do you mind being more quiet? But that neighbor says, I don't have to be quiet because you're not here. But you say, but I am here. Right. So at least to solve the problem, we would, the neighbor would have to at least acknowledge that the noise is affecting the person because the person exists with them. So we can't make any kind of progress until there is, I think, a global recognition, but especially obviously for Palestinian people and for Palestinian leaders, there needs to be a shift in their, what it is that they're fighting for. Are they fighting for the eradication of the Jewish people or the Israeli people, however they want to say it? I think in their charter they use Yehud, which is the word for Jewish. So are they fighting for the eradication of the Jewish nation, or are they fighting for the establishment of a sovereign Palestine? So that's the question. And for me, what I've been, the way I understand from the facts in their charter and what it is that they're calling for, I think their main goal right now is to just eradicate the Jewish people. And like I said, because there's over 3,000 years of these attempts on the Jewish nation, none have been successful. So you'd think that maybe now people would pick a different focus, because it hasn't been successful, and it won't be successful. It would never be successful. So being What I wish to see in the region and in the world at large, because obviously the world is also seems to be, at least, you know, it can seem this way from social media, that a lot of people have very strong opinion and are very divided on this. No one wants people on either side to live their life in suffering, and that's what's been happening, right? People on both sides are living life knowing war and pain from the time they're born. No one wants this, especially not, I can say from the perspective of an Israeli person, there would have to be very, very, very tiny, tiny majority of people who would ever focus their attention on anything other than establishing security and peace for themselves and their families. And I think most Israelis would agree that we'd give anything for the only real security, which is peace, lasting peace in the region. Like, that's what we all want. And I really pray that our leaders and our government in Israel, which have been obviously deeply unstable, have had said and done questionable things. And most Israelis have been protesting the current government, you know, for like a year now, in the thousands on the street. So clearly also a huge part of Israel disagrees with the current policies and actions of the government. But that is not to say that even though there's so much division within Israel in terms of the politics, ultimately the people want peace and they want security in the region, in the whole Middle East and in the world. Even if the Jewish people are not in Israel, wherever they may be, in Paris, in London, in New York, LA, there is a feeling of despair and a feeling of feeling very unsafe from the people that I've spoken to, Jewish friends that I've spoken to in these cities, and even family I have in London. It's a feeling of being extremely like witnessing something that you'd never thought you'd witness in your lifetime, is what I'm hearing. Just being singled out, Jewish students feeling unsafe in universities, in schools. So I think as a whole, I hope that we can wake up to the fact that Israel is a country like any other, has a right to defend itself and its people. We should all globally fight against terrorism. There shouldn't be any question about that, I think. There should be no question about this. We should all globally stand up to terror, and standing up to Hamas and standing up to terror organizations doesn't mean you can't care for the Palestinian people. You could do both. And that's what I'm hoping to do in my lifetime, is stand up for both. Stand up for the right of Israel to exist, for the right of Palestine, a sovereign Palestine, to be established and to live side by side in peace with Israel. And if we globally can't say the two together, then we have a fundamental problem, and we have to look at, again, where that problem is. Why do we have such a strong problem with the existence of the one single Jewish state in the world, which is a state that is necessary according to, if we look at history, we look at the level of attack on the Jewish nation, on a small portion of people in the world, the constant attack and persecution of these people. We've learned from 80 years ago, the murder of 6 million Jewish people, that the Jewish people need, it's not even a want, they need a country. They need they need their country, they need their homeland, and they need to be able to be protected in that homeland. So this is something that if we have doubts about, if we have questions about, I think we need to really ask ourselves where this is really coming from. And I think that we need to be okay with saying, I stand with Israel's right to exist, and I want Palestinian people to live dignified, safe, and healthy lives where they are given the right to thrive and to live with freedom and dignity. And what can we do? What can we do to make that reality actually come to fruition? Because right now it seems almost impossible, right? Right now in the state that we are right now, it seems like we're moving further and further away from that reality. But again, I think the point of this conversation is not to say that we have something necessarily personally in our hands that we can do individually to completely fix the situation in the Middle East. We don't. And it's not just in the Middle East, because I really think this is a global issue. But is to take responsibility to make sure that we're not adding more, right? More division, more suffering, more hatred, which is what social media has given people the power to do, unfortunately. Social media can be a tool for connection. It has been for me. You know, I'm grateful that I've had the ability to use social media to connect with thousands. Actually, it's hard to even process just how many people I have been able to connect with internationally and celebrate the practice of yoga, celebrate the ability of humans to feel and to love and to be compassionate and to use their intellect, all of the things that yoga promotes. Yoga promotes a sense of ethics and morality and kindness and compassion and practice and discipline, accountability, responsibility. But essentially, more than anything, a sense of compassion for ourselves and for others. And I think we can't let that be lost, especially when it's being tested, because we don't just practice and, you know, achieve a certain level of understanding or peace, and then that's it. That understanding and peace that we may have cultivated through practice is constantly going to be challenged. That's the point. It's constantly going to be challenged. So this is a huge challenge in the world right now. And it's a huge challenge individually for us to learn to hold space for our grief, for our pain, for our anger. Whether you are Palestinian or Israeli or Jewish, or you're just watching all of this unfold and feeling the pain and the confusion and the terror, we have to be able to pause before we speak, before we type, before we attack someone, whether it's on Instagram or on the street. We have to be able to pause. We have to be able to come back into our hearts and not just function from a place of, again, trauma and fear and fight. So that is where the work is. That is where the work is. I really, really hope that in our lifetime we see true leaders, people with the ability to communicate and offer true resolutions, actual methods for creating peace from the ground up, for everyday people, for leaders, for soldiers, for everyone, a way to maintain inner and outer peace. I really, really hope that this conflict can lead us to grow instead of devolve, you know, instead of go back into something that is beneath us or that doesn't elevate us. So I'm hoping, that's my prayer, is that when our minds and hearts and our realities are not going to be pulled into darkness, but that we can hold space for the darkness and convert it into light, no matter how difficult it is.
Beautiful. I hold that prayer with me as well. You spoke about the values of yoga and what yoga teaches us. And I want to connect that to religion as well, because in the base, our religion, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, in the base, they promote these same values. And it is the humans that kind of took these teachings and distorted them to the level of the mind and the separation of, okay, I'm now Jewish and you're Christian and we're different. But at the base, I see religion promoting these same values that yoga teaches us. And I think that's important to remember. Just to kind of close the conversation, we spoke about the value of life. So I want to ask you, what is the value of life for you?
I mean, there is, you can't even put it into words, because each life is a manifestation of the divine. Each life, you know, each life is not just human life, although human life is really here. Every human that is born on this earth is born to make the journey from survival consciousness to God consciousness. That is the journey. That is the ultimate reason for each being that is born here in human form. But all beings, whether they are animals, different species, plants, rocks, inanimate objects, all beings, all things have life in them. And life is something that can be observed when we're not too busy in our minds. It can be observed, and it is so incredibly mysterious and moving and fantastical, whether we're observing, we have the time. We don't really do this anymore, but I think people thousands of years ago had the ability to really look or contemplate a flower or a sunset or water as it moves through a river or a waterfall, really contemplate the mystery of the world and the universe. We're very much more distracted now. But I think life, the value of life is not something that we could ever put a measurement on. It's immeasurable. It is beyond measurement. Life is a gift from God, and it is God itself. And it is also something that is beyond birth and death, the apparent birth and death of an individual. So I have learned also through yogic teachings that no matter how painful separation on the physical realm is, right? So death is so painful experience. It's such a painful experience, especially when that death is unnatural, as someone is taken away. It's a very, very painful experience. But what gives me solace and peace is that I know, it's not a belief, it's a knowing. I know that all of those beings, all of us are born and all of us will appear. We appear to be born, we appear to die. But we are truly eternal. Those qualities, what we really are, who we really are, is eternal, is beyond time and space, beyond our names and our minds and the countries and the stories and the histories that we belong to, which are all amazing and wonderful and awaken, really allow us to function in the world. But ultimately, we are not those things. And what we really are and what we sense in life, the preciousness of life, is that thing that I'm talking about, is that eternal light, the intelligence that is behind everything. The way I can just speak to you, and my body is also breathing itself, and my heart is pumping blood, and all my organs are working, and I don't have to once think about it. It's the intelligence. So life is intelligent. Life is generous. Life is dharmic. It's like the sun. The sun never says, I'm going to take a day off, or I'm not going to shine on this part of the world because I'm, you know, taking a break from. Yeah, I have a little bit of revenge I need to take out on this one. So it's like the sun and the moon, the cosmic order of the universe is something that we can have awe at what life is. Life is a miracle. Life is a mystery. Life is every possible opportunity all at once, every possible chance all at once, every encounter a miracle, every breath a possibility. And we should never do anything to constrict the miracle of life, but to allow it to do whatever we can, to allow life to thrive and to unfold and to reflect the divine. Really, our goal here as human beings is to reflect the beauty of the divine. This place, planet Earth, is paradise. People think that there's a paradise somewhere else, but it's actually here. It's this paradise right here. It is a paradise. And unfortunately, we are so collectively, of course, there are exceptions, but collectively and really looking at it historically, have been so blind to the paradise that we humans inhabit. It is a miracle that life took place here in such a beautiful way on planet Earth. How beautiful, how generous Mother Earth is to all of us. How beautiful and generous, how incredible the variety of species and animals and trees and flowers, the beauty that is all around us, right? That is life, and we are a part of that. We are a part of it, but we are afflicted. We have afflictions in our mind as humans because of the potential for knowledge, because of the potential for understanding. We take that potential and we unfortunately direct it at manipulation or power over others instead of power over ourselves. We try and control manipulate nature and her resources instead of working alongside with nature and not to abuse nature, abuse the earth. So it is all connected. It's all connected. Life is godly. Life is divine. Life is a miracle. Life is where we have the potential to see the divine and to see ourselves in all things, in all beings. And life needs to be, we must not forget that this is not necessarily a natural realization for people. People also have to be educated to respect life, to respect nature. That's the most basic level. These are the teachings of Dharma, right? So different cultures have them in different ways, but in terms of the Indic traditions, this is what we call Dharma. Even the earth itself sometimes is called Dharma. So Dharma is righteousness. Dharma is when we are in alignment with nature, when we don't harm nature, we don't harm beings, we don't harm we don't harm or cause violence to natural resources, to animals, and of course to ourselves and each other. We respect the elderly, we respect our parents, we respect our teachers, we respect our partners and friends. This is all a part of Dharma. So that is life. Life can be observed in every moment, especially when we consider the natural world around us. All living beings have a right to exist, a right to be safe and free, a right to realize their potential. And again, we have, I'm assuming people listening are yogis, we have a duty to reduce as much as we possibly can the darkness, ignorance, harm that we are contributing to. on a daily basis.
100%. That was so beautiful. And something that really stuck with me is what you said about the sun. Like, the sun always shines. Doesn't matter if it doesn't say one day I'm mad at you, today I'm not shining at you. And my hope is that we as human beings, and the people listening to this podcast are not just Israelis, there are people from all over the world, that anybody listening, and specifically us as Israelis, choose to remember that within the conflict, that neither one of the sides deserves to be neglected or blamed or hurt because of anything that was done, and both sides have done things that are wrong. And yet I hope that we are able to keep in our hearts this remembrance that each life has a value and an importance and is part of the divine, and that we take that to move forward from this whole situation.
Amen.
Talia, thank you so, so much for this. I love connecting with you and listening to you anytime, and specifically about this topic. I really appreciate that you took the time to do this. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for reaching out. It means a lot. And I just think, what a wonderful initiative. You know, I hope that this is useful or helpful to you if you're listening. And I'm sending you in this moment so much love and support. I know that we're all feeling a lot right now, and I'm sending you my love and support. Please, everyone, stay strong and stay grounded and stay connected to your practice. We're going to make it through. We will make it through this. Thank you so much, Yael.
Now, after this time to nurture your mind and your spirit, we invite you to take a moment to consider others. A kind wish might come to mind. Know that what we learn becomes more valuable when we apply it and share it with others. So share this episode on Instagram stories, tag Yandara and I, or share with a loved one so that more people can benefit from it. Our hope is that the search will lead you home to who you already are, to what was always there. We'll be back next week with more inspiration, honest conversation, and insight into the energetic world around us. Thank you for listening and watching.